2020 January meeting of the Private Activity Bond Committee to order. We have a fairly full calendar. I do need to know who's on the phone, and hopefully everybody here is signed in on the sign-in sheet. Could the folks on the phone please identify themselves?
Larry Holzgang, Regional Development Officer for Business Oregon.
Terry Hankley,
Nick Babs,
Oregon Finance Officer.
Nick David Babs, Parker, Business Oregon.
David Parker, Business Finance Officer, Business Oregon.
Okay.
Alice Bibler with Oregon State Treasury.
Amy Mettler with Oregon Housing. Ciara Arce with Oregon Housing.
Beth Brown with Oregon Housing.
Great.
With
Eric Knoll with the City of Portland Office of Government Relations.
Okay. Anyone else? Well, this set a new record. Definitely have more people than I said that last year, so welcome all. Sorry, it's going to be a long meeting. We have time frames for the agenda items. I do want to note one slight change. I failed to give some time for Red Rock and Business Oregon to make some opening remarks before we went into executive session. So we're going to try and use the period from 10:45 to 10:50 to do that. So with that, I'm going to keep everybody on time and sort of play traffic cop. Let's begin by discussing, Mark, if you will, the current status of our carry forwards, and then the current, and then the new allocations, which should be in your first tab.
The expiring 2016 carry forward was used in full. 2017 carry forward has a remaining balance of $143 million. 2018 carry forward, which doesn't expire until 2021, has a remaining $87 million. There are carry forward requests being considered today up to $280 million with an available carry forward, 2019 carry forward of $248.87 million available. In 2020 current volume cap, there is a request for $30 million from OVDD Red Rock Biofuels, and a few of the requests were for either 2019 carry forward or 2020 current volume cap, and for the purposes of the spreadsheet, they were put in, as you see them on the spreadsheet, $30 million for 2020 current volume, and the rest was in 2019 current carry forward.
Great. Just and for the record, the 2020 allocation represents a drop to the committee of $125 million with the legislature and the governor selecting to add to Oregon House Community Services annual allocation, so a direct exchange.
Mm-hmm.
Any questions about the numbers before we start hearing testimony?
Not for me.
No.
Okay. Very good. Thank you very much, Martha. Okay, so we, as Martha mentioned, we have both carry forward and current volume requests. I think that in the interest of us deciding an optimal solution, we'll just hear from everybody. And so with that, the first order of business is Oregon Housing Community Services, who asked for carry forward. Subsequent to their request, I asked them to prepare a memo that's in your package about their pipeline and about their overall operation to give us some context of the decisions we're going to make today and how they could impact the longer-term operations of the agency. So please come on up and identify yourself. The floor is yours. So 10:30.
Good morning. Good morning, committee members. For the record, my name is Margaret Salazar, and I'm Executive Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. And with me here today is Caleb Yan, our Chief Financial Officer. We'll start today by talking through our request, and then we will also turn to how we are managing our pipeline and managing the scarcity of private activity bonds in our own operations. I want to begin today by just acknowledging for the committee that we have made a very bold ask to you today. We are requesting $225 million in carry forward And we are also requesting that the committee consider allocating or reserving all current year private activity bonds to OHCS or to local affordable rental housing issuers to address the unprecedented need for affordable housing throughout our state. The boldness of this request does match the urgency that we see in the housing and homelessness arena and the work that we do every day to address Oregon's housing crisis. I'll start today by talking through our homeownership programs and strategies, then I'll turn to rental housing, and then I'll talk a little bit about the statewide benefits of the work that we do with private activity bonds. So first, in the arena of homeownership, Oregon's homeownership rates remain some of the lowest in the country. In fact, Oregon is ninth lowest overall nationally in 2018 statistics. And unfortunately, racial disparities in homeownership rates are also staggering and stubborn. Homeownership rates for white populations in Oregon are nearly double that for many racial and ethnic groups. For example, the homeownership rate for white Oregonians is 65%, while for African Americans, it's only 35%. The good news is that private activity bonds are funding the Oregon Bond Residential Loan Program, which is a very effective tool to reaching first-time homebuyers throughout the state. We are offering below-market interest rate loans at just 2.625%, a historic low and an unprecedented rate for folks getting into the homeownership market. We're also offering a product that includes closing cost assistance at an interest rate of just 3.75%. These have proven to be very effective tools and a very effective usage of the private activity bond resources here across the state. I'm also proud that we are leaning into our work to better serve communities of color with our homeownership programs. In 2019, 31% of our mortgages were made to borrowers or co-borrowers that identified as people of color. That is a significant increase, and it's thanks to some of the work that we're doing to do better outreach to those communities. The Oregon Bond Residential Loan Program is also serving both urban and rural communities. In fact, we're making mortgage loans in 29 of the 36 counties throughout the state of Oregon. Turning now to the rental housing need, I'm sure the committee is aware of the great need for affordable rental housing throughout our state. 27% of all Oregon renter households have what we call a severe housing cost burden. That means that they're paying more than 50% of their income just toward rent. We all know that if you're spending more than half of your income toward rent, you're really in the danger zone. You're just one family emergency away from potentially falling behind on your rent and falling into homelessness. That's why affordable housing is so critical. Unfortunately, here again, housing cost burdens are falling disproportionately on our communities of color. More than 50% of African American households, Native American, Alaskan Native, and Pacific Islander households, and households that identify as other race or two or more races, are housing cost burdened compared to just 3% of white households. We have a crisis on our hands of affordability. But the good news here again is that our rental housing programs made possible by private activity bonds are opening more doors than ever before, and we're having a significant impact on creating new housing opportunities throughout the state. Over the last 3 years, thanks to prior allocations from this committee, we've been able to create more than 4,000 homes using private activity bond funded programs. And for the LIFT program alone, we have been able to create more than 800 new homes. In just the last year of 2019, we currently have more than 1,900 homes under construction using a blend of the LIFT program, which is a state-funded program, with private activity bonds. So this is a very, very effective affordable housing production tool. It's one of our most effective strategies, and you can see examples of that right here in Salem on Portland Road. The Cornerstone Apartments is a great example of that, 180 homes that are now occupied by low-income families thanks to the work that we have done with private activity bonds. You all are probably aware that we have a supply shortage here in Oregon. We estimate that from 2000 to 2015, the state of Oregon underbuilt by more than 150,000 homes. We stand ready to increase our affordable housing production. As I mentioned, we're opening more doors than ever before, and with additional private activity bonds, we will continue that work. I want to turn now to talk about the economic benefits to the state and the statewide impact of our programs. In 2019, our $253 million in private activity bonds for rental housing not only provided tax-exempt financing and lower interest rates to let folks get this work done, it also brought in $158 million in tax credit equity to the state of Oregon. To be clear, this is dollars to build affordable housing that would otherwise not come into the state of Oregon. So we're leveraging private activity bonds and state dollars to bring in private and federal investment that would otherwise go to other parts of the country. We have made priorities through our statewide housing plan to serve rural communities as well as communities of color through our equity and racial justice initiatives. For rural Oregon, it's well known in the affordable housing industry that developments in rural communities are particularly challenging, in part due to the small size of these developments. Oregon's investment in the LIFT program is an example that has enabled rural developments to use private activity bonds, recognized just recently with an award from the National Council of State Housing Agencies as a game changer for rural Oregon. LIFT projects have been created in rural communities including Astoria, Yahats, Newport, Ontario, Hermiston, Sisters, Lapine, and many other small rural communities. And I believe we actually have a handout that we can share with you that gives more information about where some of these projects have been created. Through our equity and racial justice priorities, we are also using private activity bonds to help better serve communities of color. All of our private activity bond allocations that we pair with state dollars require our development and sponsors to plan using affirmatively furthering fair housing to best reach communities in need, to plan on how they will equitably serve racial and ethnic demographics in the communities where they're built, to address gentrification and displacement issues, and as we're moving forward on goals toward using minority and emerging small women business contractors. We're also specifically leaning into the need for larger bedroom size units when we use private activity bonds and the LIFT program because we have such a high rate of family homelessness throughout the state of Oregon. Finally, I'll turn to economic benefits and contracting. According to a study from the National Association of Home Builders, the one-year impact of building 100 rental apartments include $11.7 million in local income, $2.2 million in taxes and other revenue for local governments, and 161 local jobs. And as I mentioned, we as an agency are moving forward on our goals to expand economic opportunity for minority women and emerging small business contractors. So with that, I'll turn now to Kayla Biant, who will talk a little bit about how we are best utilizing private activity bonds and maximizing every dollar.
Thank you, Director Salazar. Again, for the committee, my name is Kayla Biant. I'm the Chief Financial Officer here at Oregon Housing Community Services. And as Director Salazar said, this is a different type of ask for us, and we're aware of it. That's why we wanted to give this sort of context. I think one of the things that we take very, very seriously is with this potential allocation of private activity bonds, we need to make sure that they are put to highest and best use, that we're getting the most value we can for every dollar that goes towards affordable housing, whether that be homeownership or rental housing. So I'm going to go through some strategies that we've already employed and then some things that are on the horizon as it relates to our utilization of private activity bonds. So turning first to the homeownership programs or the single family programs, there's a number of things that we've already done. One of the key pieces is utilizing replacement refundings, or essentially taking principal and interest prepayments that we get from loans in our single family and using that to purchase new loans, and so through a refunding mechanism. Another way is blending taxable and tax-exempt bonds, and so that's something that we've historically done, and we're really looking to see maximize the blend rate that we can in order to use as much taxable as possible in order to still offer the borrower benefits in our programs. So through using those two tools, we think we probably can get an additional about 30% more utilization out of private activity bonds. In other words, for every $100 million in private activity bonds that go to that program, we probably could do about $130 million in volume. But that's tools that we're currently using. You'll notice, and later on in our second time that we're at this table, we'll be talking through our pipeline in a lot greater detail. But one of the items that is on that is the fact that we're assuming $120 million per year volume in the Oregon Bond Residential Loan Program, the home ownership program. In 2018, we did $250 million. This last year, we did $140 million. There's opportunities to do significantly more than $120 million, but as we'll talk through, the kind of unprecedented pipeline that we have in rental housing is making us really evaluate to ensure that we could utilize this tax credit and build the housing that we need as far as the rental housing units. Related to that, we have been in the process of launching a new single-family lending tool. So this is essentially mortgage-backed securities that is sold on the secondary market. It's different programs that are available from the GSEs as well as from FHA that are only available to state housing finance agencies. And it's a way that allows us to continue lending and doesn't utilize private activity bonds. So that was part of our budget ask from this last session. We're in contract negotiations right now with a service provider in order to have this lending tool available in case in future years we need to allocate more of our private activity bonds towards rental housing. So that's kind of on the single family side of things or the homeownership side of things. As far as multifamily or the rental housing, recently we brought to our advisory body, the Housing Stability Council, a new policy to limit the amount of private activity bonds that go into any 4% low-income housing tax credits to no more than 55%. Part of the regulations for the 4% low-income housing tax credit is private activity bonds have to be at least 50%. So essentially, we're by limiting it to 55%, we're making sure we don't over-subsidize these projects. We keep building as many projects as possible with the private activity bonds that we have for rental housing. And the last piece as far as stuff we've already done is that in prior years, we used to ask for the carry forward to either come to multifamily or single family. As this committee is very well aware of, the carry forward piece is kind of the use or lose portion of the private activity bonds. And so in the last couple of years, we've asked for carry forward to only go to multifamily. We're going to continue to do that. Furthermore, we want to be clear on a point that is in the memo that we don't have to issue the bonds to go with a 4% low-income housing tax credit. We're okay if local issuers do that in order to take advantage of that tax credit. But we do have this pipeline that we know will use the carry forward. So our position on that is that if a local issuer wants to issue their own bonds, we are totally comfortable with them getting current year allocations, but we ask that carry forward go to Oregon Housing Community Services because we have a pipeline that we know will use that carry forward in case the project gets delayed or something along those lines. Shifting quickly over to what is in process or what is on the horizon, there's a couple pieces. One is through the National Council of State Housing Agencies, as Director Salazar mentioned. We're helping advocate for a Tax Credit Improvement Act. We'll do a number of things through the federal low-income housing tax credit. As Director Salazar said, it's probably the biggest production tool that we have. As it relates to private activity bonds, it would allow us to refund any short-term bonds used for multifamily or rental housing and utilize that for single-family or home ownership. So that could potentially allow us to essentially reuse that private activity bonds from multifamily for single-family and get a lot more production in our state. So that's one of the key provisions in that would have a huge benefit to our agency and really citizens across the state. The last piece that is, this one is very much more on the horizon, is we are doing a lot of learning from our HFA partners on the West Coast. Washington State Housing Finance Commission in Washington and Cal HFA, they both have been at a scarcity of private activity bonds for a number of years. They both have moved to competitive offerings of the 4% low-income housing tax credit. That is, just to be very clear, that is a tax credit that is only constrained by the availability of private activity bonds.
So just to be clear, who's competing? People who are going to put together the housing deals, and so that means you're likely to get closer to 100 cents on the dollar for the value of the tax credit?
It's not necessarily affecting the tax credit pricing. The competition is within the state amongst developers who are competing for that 4% allocation from the state.
And what is the criteria for, is it lottery or is it What do they get to do to...
Well, this is an on-the-horizon piece. I mean, very candidly, that we have... Private activities bonds haven't been scarce. And so we have not run a competition for the 4% tax credit because it has been a constrained resource.
Right.
As we're leaning towards, it is, and we are really taking to heart the highest and best use of these dollars, that is something that we're working with them to see what has worked well, what hasn't worked well. Is this something that we should implement to make sure that our policy priorities and our statewide housing plan are lived out through our allocations of the 4% tax credit?
And just to be clear, because we have a lot of interested parties in the room today, we are not announcing that we are implementing this in 2020, but we wanted to just put it on the table for the committee so that you understand in the mix of things that we're having to consider in terms of the scarcity of private activity bonds and how to squeeze every dollar for maximum impact. It's something that we have to consider looking at. Obviously, the more private activity bonds we have to work with, the less we will have to look at doing a competitive process.
And I do want to save a few minutes for questions, and I do have a question, and I don't know if they do this in California, but you could build an 8-story skyscraper out of wood in downtown Portland, or you can build on raw land in Eugene or Salem. Do you have a rough idea of what it's costing per unit? Now we know you do small, medium, and big, but what right now is the cost, the average cost per unit of the 1900? I mean, I did some math myself to guesstimate, like if you take the tax credit plus the PAB plus the lift.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know off the top of your head roughly what we're paying?
Because
I wonder if that might not be a criteria to encourage statewide cost-effective solutions rather than less cost-effective solutions for the same PAB dollar.
Yeah, thank you for the question about the cost. I'll say a couple of things about that. All of our programs do have requirements in terms of cost containment. So the federal programs have some requirements. We typically have some additional requirements for cost effectiveness and cost containment that we bake into our programs. A lot of the new state programs that have come online, for example, LIFT, also have us specifically looking at subsidy per unit that the state is putting in.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you can make a deal pencil out, we're not as focused on the per unit cost as we are on how much public dollar is going in from the state. So, for example, LIFT has some pretty stringent per unit subsidy limits. And then we do report this out to the legislature annually. So I don't want to misquote a per unit approximation here, but we can,
you know, there's like I said, there's single room occupancy, there's 3-bedroom units.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. We're actually starting to talk more about cost per resident as opposed to cost per unit, because we know there's a critical need for these 2- and 3-bedroom units that we've underbuilt, and we have, as I mentioned, such a high rate of family homelessness that we don't want to shortchange those families. And so rather than give you a number off the cuff today, we'd rather, if it's okay with the committee, follow up with that detail.
Well, I was asked by legislators last week at the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission, so just something that is on their horizon, which is, again, you know, thinking through if a project involves, let's say, remodeling an old hotel in Astoria, whether the local government needs to kick in for some of those costs that would not be there if we build on bare land.
Mm-hmm.
And so the state is making sure wherever we're putting money, we're being fair to all communities, and then if people want additional amenities, then they get to pay for the cherry and the frosting on the top of the cake.
I haven't seen a lot of cherries or frosting on any of our developments. So I can assure you point well taken.
Dollar,
yep.
In a way that's fair.
Yes.
So, and I didn't have an answer. Well, just doing the back in the envelope, and it's an average, so it's meaningless. But you did 1,019.22, and I figured out how much carry forward you used last year. So I roughly came out to give or take on average 130. Grand per unit, just to pick a number, a PAD, and then all the other stuff on top of it. The reason I'm asking is that when we hear other presentations about other uses like MCC tax credits, what I'm trying to get at is, you know, how many, again, like you said, residents are covered.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, it's about bang for buck.
Right. Absolutely.
So
And prospectively, with your shift in taxable tax-exempt funding mix, the gearing's going to improve.
Right, right, right.
Can't tell you how much, but it will improve.
Sure.
Other questions from board members at this point?
No. Have you done one of your blended multifamily financings yet?
At the 55%?
Yeah.
I think we have done them historically, but I don't know since we've adopted the policy. I think it's a brand new policy.
It's a brand new policy. The 55% policy was just adopted a month or two ago. So we'd have to look to see, you know, what level of tax exempt went into those specific. Mm-hmm. I would imagine some of them were closer and some of them were.
I think your report was terrific, by the way. And we love this level of detail. Just keep shooting in the as-builts as to kind of how this is playing out, because I personally am very interested in this.
One thing I also wanted to point out was it's hard to know if certainly Metro and City of Portland both have GO bonds for gap funding. And in the detailed in the back, I just wanted to point out that some assumptions were made that at least some of the projects would come through Oregon Housing. I think it's about $68 million of Metro projects. And there's also some permanent supportive housing projects, and then a little bit of Portland Housing Bureau. And I know that Home Forward is going to be presenting at least some of the 85 stories that I think they're going to talk about is embedded in the numbers. So just to be clear that
yes.
mm-hmm. I feel like the agency is trying to recognize they can't do everything for everybody, but to the extent that those projects are ready to go and they're going to get tax credits anyway, they've included them in the forecast mm-hmm. numbers.
Absolutely, and just a teaser for our next presentation on that. For instance, the Metro money, the $538 million bonding measure, that is a huge chunk of gap financing that will most of it will utilize private activity bonds. In our projections that go through the year 2022, we're assuming that 25% of that will be used really in the years 21 and 22, $68 million per year. And the rest of it, likely those bonds won't be issued until past 22.
And we've been asking, and Mr. Anderson's been asking for some information, so that's why I wanted him to know.
Yep. No, it's,
at least some of those projects will get leveraged through tax credit.
Yes.
Okay. Any further questions? Questions from
the table? No, very helpful.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Our next presenter is Portland Housing Bureau has requested $40 million in PAB to fund $10 million in mortgage credit certificates. So please identify yourself for the record and floor is yours.
So for the record, my name is Matthew Schaubold. I'm the Policy and Planning Manager with the Portland Housing Bureau. And I'd like to start off by talking a little bit about the landscape in the Portland metro area, and then I'll turn it over to Dory to speak a little bit more to the program specifics. So. In the city of Portland, well, in the region, we, in the last 5 or so years since the recessionary recovery and the housing crisis really didn't begin but really started to expand, we have invested over $1 billion locally to fund affordable housing rental development, home ownership, anti-displacement and stabilization initiatives, and homeless services. In the city proper, it's well over $500 million, and this has come in the form of reallocating our tax increment financing, passing both the Metro bond and the Portland bond, passing some other local taxes, as well as allocating the general fund. And so I wanted to give the committee just a picture of kind of the spectrum of what our priorities are locally, and then speak to why home ownership is a critical component and the MCC program is a large component of trying to reach some of our minority homeownership goals locally. So we have roughly 15,000 units that the city has financed and regulates in our entire portfolio. We currently have around 3,700 regulated affordable units in our pipeline in some stage. And so we've made a lot of progress in recent years in increasing the number of regulated affordable housing units, which is critical to addressing the housing crisis locally. In addition, the city and the county are funding the Joint Office of Homeless Services that has been created as the crisis has increased to the tune of slightly over $30 million a year for the past few years. And the home ownership portion of our work is primarily funded through some federal funds, tax increment financing, and our indirect programs like our SDC waivers, our MCC programs, and other indirect programs. The MCC currently supports about half of the households that we serve in achieving homeownership. And we have, as a city, been increasingly focused on, both for renters and for homeowners, anti-displacement and stabilization initiatives, as we've seen both rents increase and home prices increase around the city. And so our median sales price in the city was over $400,000 last year. And the measure we use for homeownership affordability is roughly below $300,000, and there are only two neighborhoods where it's affordable at that sales price, and that's fallen from over half the neighborhoods in the city. So while there is a crisis in homelessness and affordable rental housing, there is also the very real reality that our city is becoming unaffordable for communities of color, for single parents, for working families to be able to purchase a home, and the MCC is a critical piece of that. And so we wanted to be here today. We'll spend most of the time talking about the program details, but if you have questions about some of the broader initiatives and priorities of the city, or the housing bureau specifically, we're happy to speak to that.
Any questions from board members?
Yeah.
Just something that I asked for to be in here is just sort of a long-term historical. I know that when the program first started, we asked for pretty regular reports on ability to serve a variety of different minority communities, and I know that there are some struggles, at least in the early years, to achieve that. I think initially we thought it would be used for families. It's really not really a family program, but it's been useful for first-time younger home buyers. So are you happy with your ratios? Do you feel like you've met your targets? The percentage, you know, the goals have changed in terms of how many minority homeowners you're able to attract. I know prices have gone up. It's just that among the programs, Oregon Housing Community Services Department discontinued their program in the 90s because of the reduction in the value of a PAB by 4-to-1 and other down payment assistance programs that maybe could provide the same level of help. So I don't know if you've, are you happy with these results? Because it's mostly hitting median income families, not lower income families.
Yes.
In terms of down payment assistance. So can you talk about, just because, again, we were happy to give allocation when we had a lot of allocation, but now we're looking at what's the most efficient way to really help minority communities and the types of communities that need help.
I'm Dori Van Bockel, a manager with the MCC and other programs with the Housing Bureau. So thank you, committee members, for having us here today. So as you can see, you know, the numbers have varied a little bit with the market as it has varied over the years of the program since inception in 2008. And yes, we've seen challenges over the last couple of years to the impact of the price increase and how many owner or home buyers were able to actually target then with the program because the loan amounts have gone up. Certainly the average loan amounts and the average sale price is still well below market, so we're helping impact households that are very much finding those opportunities within the city. And we've thankfully had an increase over the last couple of years in our target of reaching communities of color. And as Matthew had mentioned a little bit, some of the other work that the Housing Bureau and community partners are doing within the city to work with anti-displacement and other measures such as our North Northeast Preference Policy has allowed us to continue to strengthen our partnership with our community partners, primarily those working directly with communities of color impacted by the staggering prices and displacement and other issues. And they're also partners we work with for that home buyer education, for the other foreclosure prevention programs and other. As Matthew also mentioned, without the impact of the MCC program, it would reduce the households served by the City of Portland by about half through whom we're able to reach with the MCC program. And so even though we haven't always reached the 30% goal of communities of color, we're recognizing the large number of households that are still being served. The program itself allows for income, you know, well over 100% of median income, yet we're still regularly seeing the average income of those being served to be closer to 90% over the program, which is just barely outside of who is able to access our down payment assistance program. We also, as was requested with the original allocation, comparing every application of the MCC that comes in against the Oregon Bond Program, and if it's not a more beneficial program or the lending requirements are, you know, might require a larger down payment or something else, we won't approve the MCC and we'll refer an applicant to the Oregon Bond Loan so that we're able to make sure that the resources are going to the most impacted or, you know, household that could use it most. And we continue to be able to utilize the program and the allocations and award within the time. So, I mean, certainly recognizing that over the life of a loan, a household could benefit about $42,000. It allows for a household to really be able to build that stability of homeownership. An example of a recent applicant who purchased a home with the program, it was a couple who actually were not like a lot of first-time home buyers in that they were in their 50s and 60s together, but had have been living in actually assisted or in rental housing assisted through in a project with funds from the Housing Bureau, and were had peaked over the income limits of their rental housing and were able through the MCC program to move into home ownership. And so it allows for a couple like that to be within the whole continuum that the city wants to offer for housing. It happens to be an African-American couple who worked with a local nonprofit organization to achieve the dream of home ownership through that partnership. And it you know, allows for us to see that there really is still an impact that the program is able to serve.
So if we were given a grant of $40 million 2 years, whether it's carried forward or new allocation, how many households, I won't be able to get you to residents, but it's usually 2 to 3 people from the district.
Yeah.
How many households would you be able to serve?
We're thinking
with $40 million.
It's about 140.
So just the math I did a little earlier, just $40 million would generate at the 131,000 that I just, over 300 units multifamily. So I just, the unfortunate part of MCC is that it's not dollar for dollar under federal law. So another thing we should try and fix under tax equity is why give us a three-quarters haircut if we want to help assist a family have a tax credit. That just seems ridiculous and inequitable, to be perfectly blunt. But it is not the most efficient use if you're trying to build lots of units in the state, all things being equal. So I just wanted to do the math for people.
And if I may, just kind of a comment on that for Portland specifically. You know, we are in a housing, our housing landscape right now, you were getting close to our subsidy for rental housing or home ownership being in that area. So we currently provide gap financing with a per unit maximum of about $100,000 to $115,000 per unit.
So and you're using tax increment primarily?
That's a combination of tax increments. Sometimes we use federal funds, the bond funding,
construction
excise tax funding. So our on the rental side, the subsidy is around $100,000 to $115,000 per unit. And so, again, I'm not as familiar with the rest of the state, understanding you're weighing the pros and cons of the state as a whole, but we do see that the overall subsidy that we're providing locally are very comparable between both our MCC homeownership program and our DPEL homeownership program, versus our gap financing and rental housing.
Sure. But we could get 300 units
everywhere
else in the state
versus
100 and something units in Portland.
Understanding
so
that.
What
we'll
have to weigh. Well, thank you.
Certainly there aren't other subsidies generally involved in this, too, and the home buyers are able to benefit from the MCC through their qualifying factors.
Absolutely. Thank you. If there's no other questions, I had a schedule. I think it's really good.
I don't have any questions. Thank you for the information.
No.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I'm going to give the folks from Business Oregon and Red Rock LLC, you've got 5 minutes before going to executive session. 5 to 10, how's that?
Thank you. Chair McCall, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Saris. I'm going to go ahead and let Jeff Manernack take the first couple of minutes to talk about the Red Rock Biofuels project, and then I'll provide a general overview of where the department's at in the processing of the request from Red Rock.
Thank you, John. For the record, Jeff Manternack, CFO of Red Rock Biofuels, LLC. Thank you, committee members, for the opportunity to provide a project update and to request your help in combating two of our most vexing problems as Oregonians. Briefly, we set out 2 years ago to construct the world's first biorefinery to convert waste woody biomass into renewable jet and diesel fuels. And we are well underway. I'm happy to report, as you can see in these two recent photos, I had easels and everything else, but I don't want to block anybody else's view. Absolutely. Thank you very much. So that is the current scene down in Lakeview. That's our project site from just a few days ago. And there's a little more snow on the ground today, but otherwise, you know, we've got 50, 60 folks out there every day working furiously to build our plant. You know, we discovered some challenges, particularly in the gasification area during the course of our detailed design work. Also, the world does not stand still simply because we are under construction. 2 years ago, who had heard of flight shaming, for example? Adversity sharpens the sword. We redesigned the gasifier area to both resolve the design challenges we discovered and also position the biorefinery to sequentially reduce the carbon intensity of our fuels, which unlocks significant new revenue streams. We don't need to stop flying. We need to stop the negative impact of flying and using these heavy transport fuels. The process changes that we are making at Lakeview make this possible. We're positioning the Lakeview biorefinery to produce the lowest carbon jet fuel in the world. So we come today before you to ask for your help. We are increasing our investment in Lakeview and its people. During operations, so set aside the job creation during construction, but during its operations, we'll now employ 44 people directly. That's up 42% from our funding in 2018. We've already hired 34 of those folks, and the impact can be felt in Lakeview. And 44 people may not sound like a lot, but let's put that in perspective. So the 7-county metro Portland area is about 3/4 of the size geographically of Lake County, and it has about 2.5 million people here in the Portland metro area. Our plant in Lakeview will directly employ about 0.5% of Lake County's roughly 8,000 people. Around Portland, that would be 12,500 jobs. That's Nike size. It's noticeable. We create high-paying jobs so that people can afford housing and other necessities. Indirect and induced jobs during operations now total 215 people, up 31%. And about 100 of those are indirect jobs in harvesting and transporting that woody biomass to Lakeview. That's really critical out in rural Oregon, especially in Klamath County, where the unemployment rate is 5.3% compared to Portland Metro's 3.1%. Using that waste woody biomass, of course, is also critical to help tackle the growing problem of catastrophic wildfire here in Oregon and across the rest of the western United States. We use that waste woody biomass that would otherwise be burned up in slash piles, and we serve as a really important local source of demand for pre-commercial thinnings so that forest managers can reduce stocking on their land and reduce the risk of catastrophic wildfire. Business Oregon continues to be a wonderful partner and is allocating fully half of their 2020 allocation to the Lakeview project. We come before you today to respectfully request a total of $45 million, 15 of carry forward and 30 of current year. Of course, we're open to whatever mix it could be in. We respectfully request that from the PABC to help us continue to invest in Lakeview.
Thank you, Jeff. Chair Lockwood McCall and members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Saris. I'm the finance manager at Business Oregon. As Jeff laid out, this is a project that the committee and the department had a chance to take a look at a couple of years ago, and it did receive about $240 million of PAB allocation to fund a bridge loan close in 2017, followed by a full close in April of 2018. Late in 2019, as Jeff indicated, Red Rock approached Business Oregon with a need for additional funding to help address cost overruns necessary to complete the project. In the initial application submitted by Red Rock in October, it identified about a $69 million project utilizing $65 million in tax-exempt bonds to fund equipment, finance-related costs, and contingencies. As Jeff had alluded to, the applications submitted to PAB were for a total of $45 million in allocation. The department had requested on behalf of Red Rock $15 million in 2019 carry forward and $30 million in 2020 current year allocation. We'd just like to note that Business Oregon did return about $15 million of unused PAB allocation to the committee at the end of 2019. If the project were awarded allocation, the department's really indifferent as to whether it would come from carry forward or current year. Given the limitations with carry forward, it would make sense to use as much current year as possible. In the event the project didn't fund or close, then the allocation would then revert back to the committee. After submission of the carry forward application to the committee, Red Rock had notified Business Oregon that it wished to revise and resubmit its application, increasing costs of about $25 million to the project. The current request from Red Rock is for $95 million in project financing, and Red Rock's current request is for $65 million in tax exempt and about $24.5 million in taxable. The use of proceeds for the bonds would primarily be for equipment-related costs, but it would also cover capitalized interest, debt service reserve funds, contingencies, cost of issuance, and underwriter's discount.
John, have you submitted that to us? Because I don't have a $95 million source of the uses in my book.
I'm going to ask David.
Yeah.
It should be in the revised memo that the department submitted with the current year allocation.
Okay, well, we'll talk in executive session about the details, because mine only shows additional funds of $7 million.
And that was for the carry forward allocation.
But it doesn't include the taxable part. So, okay. I wanted to understand how that is going to be fine.
It's been proposed by Red Rock that the taxable bonds and tax-exempt bonds that were, if they were to be issued, would be senior term bonds, and the latest closing schedule submitted by Red Rock proposes a closing date the week of March 30th. Business Oregon is acutely aware of the current demands and future demands of prioritization of private activity bond allocation to support affordable housing. Business Oregon's had multiple meetings with Red Rock and the investment bankers at Goldman Sachs, clearly outlining the prioritization of this by the governor, the legislature, and the Department of Housing and Community Services. As mentioned, Red Rock's application has been submitted to the department, and it has been reviewed by its finance committee. About 3 weeks ago, the committee met to review the application and Red Rock's request for approval of the Declaration of Intent and Eligibility Resolution. The committee did approve both of those in an amount not to exceed $89.5 million in financing. And part of that, the committee also approved use of bond for capitalized interest costs through April 1st of 2021. Ultimately, bond counsel will determine the amounts that could be used for tax-exempt bonds. As Jeff mentioned, this project represents a new integration of independent and existing technologies on a commercial scale to convert woody biomass to solid waste, primarily jet fuel and diesel. There were concerns outlined by both the department and the committee back in 2017 and 18, but there are also positive economic benefits and environmental benefits and public benefits related to the project. To run through the positive benefits, first and foremost, the project proposes, if successful, to create 44 permanent jobs, as Jeff mentioned, 215 induced and indirect jobs, and 565 construction jobs to the community of Lakeview. This is one of Oregon's most rural communities, and it's been one of the distressed communities in Oregon for quite a few years. This also project would create economic diversification in the area. This is a region that hasn't seen anything new in the way of developments like this for decades. And again, Lakeview is a very rural community, being 2 hours from Klamath Falls, 3 hours from Medford and Bend. Red Rock is a small business, and the project encourages use of Oregon's natural resources. They, again, plan to produce renewable energy fuels. And as Jeff mentioned, by removing the woody biomass from overgrown forests, the operations will help reduce the risk of catastrophic wildfires in Oregon. Again, with all the positives with that, there are risks and concerns, and we'd just like to highlight that the department, in its role as a conduit issuer, is going to look to the purchasers of the bonds, which are restricted to qualified institutional buyers, to analyze all the information, perform the due diligence necessary to determine the viability of the projects and the risks associated. These investors may factor their perceived risks into the price of the bonds or choose not to purchase them at all. Further, IDB projects are not an obligation of the state, but rather solely the obligation of the underlying borrower, in this case, Red Rock Biofuels. The concerns that the committee had raised regarding the project were very similar to those that were raised when we reviewed the project in 2017 and 18. First, the project lacks third-party equity investment. Other than the $70 million of Department of Defense grant for construction costs, the 2018 and proposed 2020 bonds would be comprised of a capital stack, which is almost exclusively debt. With no third-party equity investment, the 2020 bonds would be now even more highly leveraged. Risks of cost increase do continue to exist. As Jeff mentioned, the engineering is substantially more complete than when we reviewed it last time. That said, while it's complete, it's nearly complete. It's not done, and one could argue that that means there's additional risk for cost overruns. Conversely, nearly complete, that risk is also reduced because the engineering's nearly finalized. There is potential reputational risk to the state if the project were to fail, which has happened with several high-profile alternative energy projects that received public assistance. The town of Lakeview and Lake County have both made and are preparing to make sizable investments in infrastructure to water and wastewater systems and the local rail system to support the project. If the project were to fail, without the revenues from Red Rock, this would put additional burden on the taxpayers of the community. And then there are various business risks that obviously will continue to be worked on. Offtake agreements must be extended. Performance insurance policies must be amended. Bondholder consent must be obtained. But we assume all of these would need to happen before the bonds could be sold. For these and other reasons, the Business Oregon had offered qualified support for the project in 2017 and 18, and we continue to offer qualified support, noting that the concerns are now elevated as some of them remain and have not been adequately addressed to either the department or the Finance Committee. We recognize there's a number of questions, and we do have a couple of other things that we would share for the executive session.
So with that, the Project Leaders Committee will now meet an executive session pursuant to ORS 192.660F. The statute allows committee to meet an executive session to consider records that are exempt from public inspection under ORS 192.355.17 and ORS 192.355.10. As information submitted to the Oregon Business Development Department by Red Rock Biofuels, LLC, an applicant for a loan for economic development from OBDD, which were forwarded to the committee by OBDD under the same considerations as confidentiality as the information was originally submitted to OBDD. And I did find the modified version.
Great.
I know it was in my book, so that's good. Representatives of the news media, designated staff, and company representatives are allowed to attend this executive session in the Umpqua Room, which is to our right, across the hall. All other members of the audience are asked to remain in the Columbia Conference Room, or if you need to use the bathrooms, the staff can walk you across the hall and let you back in. Representatives of news media are specifically directed not to report on or otherwise disclose any of the discussions during this executive session, except to state the general subject of the session as previously announced. No decisions will be made in this executive session. At the end of the executive session, which is scheduled for 11:05, we will return to open session in the Columbia Conference Room. So with that, let's start the call. We have a separate phone line. We'll be back.
Right,
Hi. Well, it took longer than we anticipated, but so be it. So we are back in regular session. A few questions for Jeff. Would you like to ask some public questions? With the revised plan, Jeff, could you talk about the use of the capitalized interest and your plan for how you use taxable? I noticed that you'd like to get taxable allocation for one additional year. Talk about that a little bit and the reasons why you need a capitalized interest and then how you'll deploy the taxable ones.
Yes, of course. So again, for the record, Jeff Mantronak from Red Rock Biofuels, LLC. We'll be using the capitalized interest to extend the period of construction to handle these process changes. So, you know, what we're doing is pushing the capitalized interest date out from April of this year until April of next year on both the existing bonds plus what would be the new issuance. So that's where the capitalized interest is devoted. We'll be using that time to both finish construction of the asset and then, of course, run through a startup period so that we get the plant up and running and able to cash flow the principal and interest payments.
And as far as I've noticed in cash flow, there's $6.5 million of additional project costs. What I saw in the numbers around, but I saw some dollars above and beyond.
Yeah. Most of that is related to the second stage of the process, the Fischer-Tropsch process. So what we ended up doing was splitting the capacity between two different providers. And so there's some additional catalyst cost. There is additional license fee related to that. So that's really the bulk of the additional project costs.
Okay. And then can you give us the status of bondholder consent and extension of the contracts for the purchasers and the fuel once the plant's open?
I'd be happy to. So we have spoken with bondholders recently regarding this plan of finance. Our bond documents do require consent for issuance of additional debt, even a dollar of additional debt, and the plan is to go to them once we have a final breakdown between taxable and tax-exempt to request formal approval for issuance of all of the bonds. Regarding status of the offtake agreements, those are being passed back and forth between the counterparties. We feel very good about that. We've extended them a number of times in the past, and both of our airline partners are very much looking forward to first fuel delivery.
And finally, the Defense Department grant. What is the final date you must be completed to get the final dollars for that portion?
The final end date on our DPA award is several years into the future. Off the top of my head, approximately 3 years out.
Other questions from committee members?
No, not at this time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, so next I'd like to hear from Home Forward. We're going to talk about the internet request before us today, but they do have a pipeline project, and so come on up and state your name for the record.
Sure.
And what happened to you on your hair?
Oh, that I can't answer.
Short hair and follow these days.
Yeah. I'm giving in a reality. good morning, Commissioners. That's fine. I could take it. No, you don't.
Okay.
You know me well enough. I could take it. So, Jonathan Trett, Director of Development at Home Forward. Thank you, Commissioners, for the opportunity to do this quick update, and I will make it quick. I do not think I need 15 minutes. What I wanted to do, as you said, we don't have an ask in front of the committee that we anticipate, certainly not today or even this year. We are continuing with the preservation of our public housing. We've been doing that in, I'll say, bundles of roughly 300 units at a time. There are two of them that are underway right now. One of them is almost all done. That's Group 5. We got an allocation of private activity bonds from the committee in 2018 for that. Group 6, OHCS provided funding, and so Group 6 was the bond issuer. OHCS was the bond issuer, which really helped with the financing on that project, and because that worked so well, as Group 7 moves forward in 2020, we hope to be able to partner with OHCS and use some of their resources and have them be the issuer as well. So the public housing preservation that's underway right now, it's a total of 665 units, a little bit about who lives there. The average income level is 18% of area median income, so these are extremely low-income households. And 10% of the households, head of households, don't disclose any racial or ethnic information. And then 50% of the households are Caucasian, and the remaining 40% head of household are persons of color. So we're clicking along with the public housing preservation. And the thing that I wanted to put in front of the committee, and I think it really echoes the presentation from earlier this morning, from Oregon Housing and Community Services, is that 2020 looks to be a really busy year for us. What we submitted in the letter is really, a best-case scenario. There's a number of competitive funding applications in the mix that that you see as possible projects, and we certainly do not presume that those will necessarily be funded because there's a lot of really good projects out there. But I think what it does highlight when you look at page 2 of the letter is that Deakin Court is a Metro Bond-funded project, and it has its architect. It will have its general contractor in about 2 weeks, and it is on its way towards breaking ground about 18 months from now. And ditto for Southeast Powell in terms of being a bond-funded project of 210 units. It has all of its funding, and it is moving headlong into schematic design and design development. So we really do anticipate those two projects, those two bond-funded projects for a total of 410 units to be 4% tax credit deals that will be requiring private activity bonds in order to generate the tax credits in 2021.
You have a sense of two.
Yeah.
Those are the total costs, so how much will PAD ask to pay?
No, those are the construction loan costs that you see there. So those will be the PAD element in order to be able to generate the tax credits.
Okay. So are those construction loans and then you're taking them out?
We're taking them out with tax credit equity and perm debt. I mean, the total costs are roughly twice that, I think you could assume.
The total cost of the project. Okay.
Because they have to be roughly
50%.
These are just the PAB funded costs
that's
you see here. Yeah, so I mean, I think it just highlights the fact that there's going to be a lot. It's fantastic that between the state and the LIFT program and other elements and other recent funding, especially along permanent supportive housing lines, and the two bonds in Portland, there's going to be a lot. There is a lot more gap money, which is necessary for these 4% tax credit projects to go. And so we, among many, will be coming and looking either to OHCS or perhaps through other issuers for private activity bonds. And with that, I think I kept it less than 5. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them either here or separately, as you like.
Are you planning on, with regard, I noticed a couple of these were coded as Home Forward being the issuer?
Correct.
Are you observing the 55% volume cap?
Yeah, we will.
Rule?
I was really happy to see that Oregon Housing proposed that and adopted as policy, and yes, we will do that.
Okay, good.
And your two projects will be coming together, how many units? I guess maybe about 70 million I'm just looking for that math number.
Oh, you're talking about the two bond funded projects?
Yeah.
They would be Deakin Court and
400 plus units.
400 units between the two of them. One is Southeast Powell, one is Deakin Court. And I would guess, I haven't looked at the total budget recently. I was just focused on the PAB amount. But you could roughly double what's that, $160 million is what I'm going to guess.
What I'm just curious is one is preservation and redevelopment, and one is brand new, and it's roughly about the same cost per unit. That was what I was most
interested
to ask.
I should have. Okay. The Deakin Court project has 40 units of preservation / development and 160 new units.
It's mostly new.
It's mostly new. It's predominantly new. Yes.
Okay. Any other questions?
No, I just wanted to comment that this was really helpful with the way you laid it out, where you had everything, including what would go through housing versus what would go through home forward, and then separately the home forward piece. It made it easier for me to understand.
Well, that is Ben's work, so thank you, Ben.
Good job. We encourage you to help the other folks in the metro region do similar work for us.
Those conversations happen, and they continue.
We hold you up as our gold standard.
Thank you. All right, I'll try not to fall down on the job.
No.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We do have a few minutes if there's additional comments from Oregon Housing that you didn't already make. If not, we can continue on to deliberation. Your choice?
I'll just really quickly, I just want to hit up maybe a few points, and this is, you don't have to look at this now, but this is a little bit of information about the LIFT program, where across the states the developments for rental housing and homeownership have occurred. Just quickly, again, for the record, Caleb Yant, Chief Financial Officer, Oregon Housing Community Services. Two main points that I want to hit. Obviously, there's some pretty detailed pipeline information in the exhibits behind our memo. Exhibit 1 shows a couple things. It shows our anticipated private activity bond use lined to carry forward. And the takeaways there is we have estimated pipeline in excess of $400 million for 2020 and 2021, and $380 million for 2022. So just the multifamily, we have a pipeline that's very large. And the other thing in Exhibit 1 has essentially a worst-case scenario for us and a best-case scenario for us of when we would potentially run out of both carry forward and current year, depending on the actions of this committee. The main points, and then the Exhibit 2 just really breaks down in detail. Next year, it's named projects because we already have funding awarded to the projects, and so we know in most cases the specific projects' names. They're actually close dates on our funding calendar, so these are very real projects. And then in 2021 and 22 was in Exhibit 2 really kind of has a breakdown of the gap financing and the private activity bond that we anticipate using based off of the Metro bond money, our LIFT bond money, our permanent supportive housing, so both the state resources and the local resources. Go ahead, Chair.
And you were able to do home ownership as well as rental housing with the seller.
Yes, we were. There's different challenges on both, but yes, we have been able to fund.
$10 million in bonding and $10 million in PAD, you've got 147 homes.
Mm-hmm.
Just comparing it to the certificate program, just by comparison.
Yeah.
Just one clarification, if I may. The LIFT home ownership program does not use private activity funds.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
It doesn't have to?
It's a different funding mechanism than the rental.
Yeah. Does the state still just own the property?
No, but we put in LIFT dollars, and there are
taxable
other sources of funds that go in.
Got it. So it doesn't...
It doesn't generate the tax credit.
That's right. It does not rely on PAB.
Yeah.
Good point. Thank you.
I guess the two main points that I want to make is, one, this pipeline is our best estimate as far as these close dates. These are complicated rental housing projects. The close dates likely will shift. We have these outlined when we think we'll close in 2020, 2021, and 22. In all actuality, some will shift from 20 to 21. Some will shift from 21 to 20. The pipeline itself is, there's a lot of strong numbers behind them, but I just want the committee to be aware when we come back next year, the close date will shift. But the actual projects have, you know, our named projects and the funding sources are funding sources that have already been appropriated to us by the legislature or already have been approved by voters in the metro area or other local jurisdictions. So one piece is that this is built off of the assumptions, and those close dates do have a tendency to shift as projects are trying to get to close. The other piece that I just wanted to call out is that there are a number of reasons why these assumptions are, although we're trying to be as precise as possible, are likely on the conservative side. So I mentioned earlier, this assumes that $68 million in private activity bonds will be used with the metro bond measure in 20 and 21. In each of those years, that's only about 25% of that gap financing. So there will be more of those projects closing. This assumes the gap money that we know of that has already been appropriated. We know even going into the short legislative session, let alone the 21 session, there's a good likelihood that we'll continue to get more gap financing, which will only put further constraints on private activity bonds. None of that is built into these assumptions. So these assumptions are based off of gap financing that is currently in place today. So.
One new area you're doing is permanent supportive housing?
Correct.
That will be some tax exempt as well as taxable?
Yes. We anticipated that we'll use the same 4% low-income housing tax credit.
Other questions?
No. Mm-hmm. Ambitious, but justifiably so.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
So this is the part where everybody's been waiting for us to now make some allocation decisions. I'm not quite sure how to go about it, but just to recap what Martha said to us, we have $248.875 million in available carry forward. We currently have three requests totaling $280 million. We also have a request for $30 million in 2020 allocation. So with that, I'm entertaining conversation, if not a motion, is how we'd like to proceed. I'll make some comments and then I'll open it up. I think that the need for affordable housing, rental housing, asking questions about MCC with a reason today, is that I'm very moved by sheer volume of homes that we need to build. I think Oregon Housing said we need 85,000 units for short.
155.
And so bang for the buck, leverage the most, get the most that we can out of these resources and tools that we have seems to me to be a really high priority. So I'm going to be, personally, and I've talked to the treasurer, who's Bodo Carey, that as I look at these allocations and requests, I'm going to be mindful of that in our decision-making. I am, however, mindful of all of the resources gone into the Red Rock project and economic development. I'm comfortable that their hard costs need to be financed, and to the extent that we have some carry forward that is designed to be for economic development specifically, that we continue to use economic development allocations to help projects in our state. So, I'm prepared to support at least the $15 million piece for Red Rock. I will say that I'm not sure we should give it to them if carry forward is new allocation. Those are the things that I think the treasurer and I agreed on before I walked in the door today, is that we want to do as much housing as we can with the recognition that the Red Rock project will be a big deal. Those are my two initial thoughts as far as highest and best use.
Yeah, I'd also like to share my thoughts. These are tough decisions that we have to make, and the certificate program through Portland
I mean, yeah, it sounds like a great program, but when you're trying to compare best and highest uses, it for that 4-to-1 trade-off, it just doesn't seem like it's going to be as much value as going through the housing programs and even the home forward programs in terms of the number of people impacted. You know, you look at giving up 40 million of PAB capacity and only affecting 138 homeowners. To me, that just doesn't feel like as much value as the number of units that are going to be produced through the other two paths, housing and community services and home forward. And then my thoughts on the Red Rock project are that, you know, yeah, it's unfortunate that these design issues have come about. It's not what anyone would have wanted to see, but this committee has supported this project for many years, and we have already made a tremendous investment in it. It's a partially completed plant sitting out there in a community that only has 2,300 people in it, and this type of getting it to the finish line, I think, will actually make quite a bit of difference in that region. So those are my thoughts.
Well, I certainly, you know, sort of what a difference a year or two makes, the metro area sort of stepping up with property tax back gap financing to the tune of something north of $800 million in terms of loading up a pipeline. At some level, it's the kind of problem we need, but it puts pressure on this committee. And the importance of making much moving away from the luxury that we have enjoyed for the last couple of years of not having to put a lot of emphasis on the efficient use of resources. Well, that was a couple of years ago. It's not today. And the efficient use of resources, I think, is really quite critical. With regard to Red Rock, I would note that this is the fifth visit to this committee by Red Rock. That thus far, quite aside from anything we do today, approximately $250 million in volume cap has been committed to that project. You know, we're deeply involved in this, you know, as are the citizens of Lake County, as is Red Rock. But this is probably a time to kind of rethink commitment, which should there be another stumble we can't recover. You know, so that's sort of an argument. If you're going to do this with current year allocation. And frankly, to you know, look for some of the other risk parties in this, the existing bondholders, to deepen their involvement with other flavors of financing, taxable financing, which is already in the current capital structure. So not a big slice, but there's some evidence that, yes, it can be used with this project. And I would be cautious in kind of committing beyond that formula.
Okay. So I'm looking for a motion. I'm looking, perhaps first we should determine how we want to use the carry forward that we have. I would make the motion that we give the entire 248.875 and change to Oregon Housing Community Services specifically for their affordable rental housing program.
Second that motion.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Done. Now let's talk about how we want to do the 2020 allocations, since our various parties said that they were willing to take either side. I would make a motion that I can't see us giving the full $45 million to Red Rock. Done the math, that's several hundred units of affordable housing, but I think that the economic development carry forward money, $15 million, I would make a motion that $15 million of our current year allocation be dedicated to the Red Rock project, and with that $20 million being committed by Business Oregon, that gets them $35 million total of their other $90 million financing plan.
Mm-hmm.
Not perfect. It's probably not what they would really like, but it feels that that is was a carry forward coming from economic development, and the Business Oregon folks have committed half of their current year allocation, so it's an important project from their perspective as well. Do I have a second?
Sure.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Now we need to address the MCC project. I just simply don't feel that this is the highest and best use of our allocation.
I don't either.
I am so sorry to deny it, but I would make a motion that we maintain the balance of our funds and allocation and do our quarterly program that we've been doing where we've been trying to allocate per quarter because metro projects may be coming and maybe not, and we'll just have to see how the rest of the calendar year unfolds.
Mm-hmm. I would rather keep with that approach because then we can see what's coming ahead, what requests are in the future instead of locking ourselves into this, which doesn't seem to be a very good use of it at this time.
Yeah. I reckon it to be about a third as effective as the same volume cap vectored to either Home Forward or their local agency peers or to Oregon Housing and Community Services.
And it's taxable. I might have gotten it wrong, but we've used $10 million in LIF funds and got 147 homeowners. City of Portland can so choose to do similar if they wanted to use GO bond proceeds to the extent possible to continue to help homeowners in whatever fashion they choose. Do I have a motion to not allocate? We've never done that before.
Yeah, we've never done that before.
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. For the record, using our quarterly approach that we agreed to, at $150 million, that works out to about $37.5 million
mm-hmm.
per quarter. We allocated 15, so that leaves roughly 22-ish. And a half
mm-hmm.
that will roll over to the April meeting.
Mm-hmm.
So collectively, we'll have a little over $50 million available. And that does bring me to the dates of the quarterly meeting. I think Martha's done some preliminary planning around that.
It's on the website. I'm sorry, I don't remember.
Yeah. I mean, there was a schedule previously circulated, wasn't there?
There was.
Yeah.
So unless there's a change, we'll continue with that plan and we'll let folks know in the community our game plan. Is there any other public testimony? Hearing none, we actually finished before 12. I adjourn the meeting.
Very good.
Thank you.
Your conference is ending now. As requested by the host, please hang up.